Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and in the early hours of Tuesday, the 30th of May, these are our main stories. Dozens of people, including NATO peacekeepers, have been injured as police clashed with Serb protesters in northern Kosovo. The United States and Saudi Arabia say the warring factions in Sudan have agreed to extend a ceasefire hours before it was due to expire. Observers from the OSCE say there was not a level playing field for Sunday's presidential runoff in Turkey, but they do not dispute President Erdogan's victory. Also in this podcast...
I've never watched hockey before, but today is an incredible win. It's a victory for the entire nation of Latvia.
How an historic win over the mighty United States brought the country to a standstill. NATO has strongly condemned attacks on its peacekeepers in northern Kosovo. 25 of its service personnel were wounded when they tried to intervene in clashes between police and Serb protesters. The demonstrators were angry at ethnic Albanian mayors being installed in Serb-majority areas. The Serbian president, Aleksandar Vučić, called for calm.
I am urging the Serbs in Kosovo, and I know how they feel and how difficult it is for them, not to get into a conflict with NATO. Not because I am afraid or because any of us are afraid. None of us personally has anything to lose, but because that's what the Kosovan leader wants most.
Owen Bennett-Jones heard more from the BBC's Balkans correspondent, Guy Delaunay.
This is all due to these, as you mentioned, this installation of ethnic Albanian mayors in majority Serb areas. There was a boycott by ethnic Serb parties and ethnic Serb voters of last month's mayoral elections in North Kosovo in four municipalities. So they went ahead with a very, very low turnout, around 3.5%. And because ethnic Serbs weren't voting, the very small number of ethnic Albanian people who live in that area went out and voted, and ethnic Albanian mayors were returned as a result. Now, international officials urged Kosovo not to press ahead with any provocative moves, instead of which, on Friday, they sent the police, forced their way into municipal buildings in three municipalities in North Kosovo so that the mayors could take office. There were very heavily armed police there, armoured vehicles, and it was just a massively provocative scene for the ethnic Serbs who live in the area, and that resulted in sharp rebukes from the US and the EU, including Antony Blinken, US Secretary of State, who said there would be consequences for the relationship between Kosovo and the United States as a result.
So what was the Kosovan authorities thinking on this? I mean, it seems it was provocative and causing them international problems.
And over the weekend, they were saying they were merely ensuring that democratically elected officials could take office. They were also insisting, rather bizarrely, that they had international support for what they were doing, which was very odd, considering that the United States, the European Union, the Quint and NATO had all come out and said that what they had done was provocative, they needed to de-escalate, and they needed to do something to reduce the tensions. None of that was done, and now you have a situation where protesters have turned out come Monday morning to try and stop people, stop the new mayors going into those municipal buildings again. They've been faced by Kosovo police and also NATO peacekeepers, the KFOR, who are trying to keep order there. And in one of these municipalities, Zvečan, it's turned violent and objects have been thrown. NATO reports there were incendiary devices which were used, which caused injuries to some of their troops. Also reports of dozens of injuries among the protesters, with one person suffering gunshot wounds.
Guy Delaunay. Sudan's army and the rival Rapid Support Forces have agreed to extend a ceasefire for 5 days. The truce, which has been repeatedly broken, was due to expire on Monday. Saudi Arabia and the United States have welcomed this latest agreement. In a statement, the US State Department said the extension would provide time for further humanitarian assistance, the restoration of essential services, and the discussion of a potential longer-term ceasefire. Earlier, the head of the UN Refugee Agency, Filippo Grandi, said the crisis in Sudan had the potential to destabilise the entire region and beyond.
There are military leaders, groups fighting for supremacy in Sudan. they obviously don't care about their own people. What I heard is stories of loss, of separated families, of hardship, of very dangerous journeys from Sudan, of people fleeing from fighting to try to find security.
The head of the UN Refugee Agency, Filippo Grandi. The US President Joe Biden has said sanctions may be imposed on Uganda after new anti-homosexuality legislation was signed into law by his Ugandan counterpart, Yoweri Museveni. Mr. Biden described the law as shameful. Homosexual acts were already illegal in Uganda, but now anyone convicted of having gay sex faces life imprisonment. Human rights activists in Uganda have filed a legal challenge, arguing the law is unconstitutional and against the right to non-discrimination. Well, healthcare organisations, including UNAIDS, have condemned the legislation, saying it was now harder for people in same-sex relationships to access life-saving health services. A member of the Ugandan parliament, Asuman Abasalirwi, told journalists the legislation was a message of defiance in the face of Western criticism.
We have no choice but to stand our ground. Otherwise, if we don't stand our ground, this is what is going to happen. Next time, they will bring another condition on our laws. Don't pass this law. If you do so, then X, Y, and Z is likely to happen. So if we don't stand our ground as a country, as a people, as a community, then we will completely have ceded our sovereignty and independence as a country.
Well, the BBC wanted to hear what people in Uganda thought about this bill. Here's one message sent anonymously.
As the LGBT community in Uganda, we are really affected. As the LGBT, we are really scared because after this law has been signed, some of us are going to lose our jobs because of the way we wear. We walk, we do everything. Everything now is at standby. Right now, what we are counting on is asylum or running away from Uganda. Because even before the law was passed, Uganda is full of homophobic people. They have been treating us badly, killing people, imprisoning people.
But there are many people in the country who support aspects of this new legislation.
Generally, the feeling amongst Ugandans is that homosexuality and all the related behaviors are generally foreign and should not be tolerated. On a personal level, I agree with the part that prohibits promotion of homosexuality, but the part where it involves punishing, capital punishment to the people caught practicing homosexuality, I would say that is to the extreme.
Our Africa regional editor, Will Ross, told us more about the new law.
Nobody's really seen the text of this piece and examined it carefully, but certainly up until now it's been even more vague that the law talking about unnatural acts. But now it's spelling out life imprisonment for people who are found guilty of gay sex, but there are also strict punishments for people who are promoting homosexuality, as well as people who are found to have, for example, knowingly passed on HIV/AIDS to somebody who is of the same sex. But it's far from clear exactly what all the punishments are. But what we do know is that the initial bill that was sent back to President Yoweri Museveni was changed because, you know, if, for example, you were a landlord and you knew that your tenant was gay, you would by law have to report them or you yourself could face a punishment. So it's not illegal to be gay, but it's the sexual acts that are still the problem according to the law.
And this was passed by a majority of members of parliament. Does that reflect attitudes in Ugandan society as a whole, do you think?
For many, many years, people generally just ignored it. Some people think being a convenient kind of issue to whip up, to focus international and domestic attention on. But I think it would be fair to say that if somebody wanted to stand as an MP and their main platform was, I am pro-gay rights, they wouldn't have a chance in Uganda. It's a very conservative society and it's also influenced more and more by religion, especially Pentecostal religion. And some of the heat around this whole debate and funding has come from the United States, where far-right conservatives and Pentecostal churches have focused on this issue and have actively promoted trying to get harsher laws in place.
Will Ross. Nigeria has a new president, Bola Ahmed Tinubu. He's 71, and after a campaign mired with questions about his health, he's taking on the significant economic challenges faced by Africa's most populous country. President Tinubu has already declared that he will end the country's fuel subsidy, considered a highly unpopular move. Our correspondent Myeni Jones is in Abuja.
Supporters of new president Bola Ahmed Tinubu descended onto Eagle Square in the capital Abuja to celebrate his being sworn in. Many of them sported ashoebi, traditional matching clothing worn during celebrations. But elsewhere in town, reactions to his becoming president were mixed.
I think he's a little bit frail for Nigeria at the moment. Nigeria is so in such a deep rut, and it needs someone that is still strong, someone that I feel Tinubu is already very tired, kind of, and I think he should, he might have a lot of problem trying to drag Nigeria out of the hole it is in at the moment.
We're talking about economy, we're talking about unity of the country, and President Bola Ahmed Tinubu is someone who is prepared for the job, and is someone that has a testament that you can testify to, even in Lagos. He ran a mini Nigeria there.
What we have to do is that is not to be against him. The best thing we have to do is that for us to pray that even though if he have any other intention, God should change his intention to be good intention so that all of us will benefit as Nigerians by this time.
Mr. Tinubu has long been a divisive figure in Nigerian politics. Some credit him with boosting Lagos' economy and improving the city's infamous traffic during his time as governor. But his detractors say he used government assets to enrich himself and is corrupt, something he denies. There are also concerns around his health. He spent time in the UK in 2021 for a non-disclosed illness and has already travelled out of the country twice since February's elections. In his inaugural speech, Mr. Tinubu sought to show he'd act decisively on key issues.
No provision is there for fuel subsidy. The fuel subsidy is gone.
Nigeria is Africa's biggest exporter of crude oil. But because it has a shortage of refineries, it imports refined petroleum at market price while selling it to Nigerians at a subsidized rate. Economists say this is unsustainable, but previous attempts to scrap the subsidy have led to protests. It's unclear when the removal of the subsidy will come into force, but having to pay more for fuel is unlikely to prove popular. Many Nigerians are already struggling to make ends meet because of high inflation and unemployment. The country's ailing economy has led thousands of young, educated Nigerians to emigrate in search of better opportunities. They're now one of the fastest-growing groups to be granted visas to the UK. Reversing this brain drain will be a tall order.
Myeni Jones in Nigeria. The entire nation of 85 million people won. That is what the newly re-elected Turkish president Recep Tayyip Erdogan told cheering crowds in Ankara on Monday. But the nation is divided. Mr. Erdogan's margin of victory was slight, and now election observers are questioning the run-up to the vote. The Organisation for Security and Cooperation in Europe say media bias and restrictions on free speech meant there wasn't a level playing field during the election period. From Ankara, our senior international correspondent, Orla Guerin, reports.
The OSCE observers said voters had a real choice on the day, but they highlighted several shortcomings in the lead-up to the election. They said the lack of balanced media coverage was concerning. Supporters of some opposition parties had faced intimidation, and the president had an unjustified advantage. But neither the OSCE nor the opposition are disputing the outcome here. The election has crystallised the divisions in Turkey, where the economy is in crisis. Critics say the president has no solutions. The Turkish lira fell again to a record low on news of his victory. Experts accuse him of mismanaging the economy, resulting in rampant inflation. But his devoted supporters have given him five more years to shape Turkey in his image and theirs, religious, conservative and nationalist. The Russian leader was one of the first to congratulate him. President Erdogan will aim to keep his close ties with the Kremlin, even if that causes friction with his NATO allies. Causing friction sometimes seems to be a foreign policy objective for the combative Turkish leader.
All Agerin. So what will Mr. Erdogan do with his new mandate? And what will that mean, not just for his compatriots, but also for the region and for a lot of the world where Turkey remains a significant player? İbrahim Kalin is a senior advisor and spokesperson for President Erdogan. Tim Franks asked him if he understands the concerns about the state of democracy in Turkey.
Of course, this is a big day for Turkish democracy with a turnout of about 85% of our people voting freely. The turnout in the first round was actually about 88%. That's really very, very high. It shows the extent to which our people pay attention and take care of their own democratic rights. And this is what they did. The result, of course, is a resounding victory for President Erdogan, who's been ruling the country for 21 years. And it's really an incredible victory, considering that he's ruled for 21 years. We have had the pandemic, war in Ukraine, economic issues, plus an earthquake, which claimed the lives of 50,000 people. So a really remarkable victory.
Sorry to interrupt. Can I just pick you up on one word that you used earlier on in your answer, which was freely? The Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, the 57 member state independent election observers, said after the first round of elections on the 14th of May that the ruling parties enjoyed an unjustified advantage because of, among other things, continued restrictions on fundamental freedoms of assembly, association and expression. Hence why I asked you about concerns over the state of democracy in Turkey.
Well, we have, of course, it's the nature of democracy, isn't it? I mean, some people will vote for one candidate and others will vote for others. And as our president stated yesterday, of course, he will rule as the president of all citizens of the country, whether they voted for him or not. In regards to free and fair elections in Turkey, I've heard this comment by some analysts and in Europe and the United States that the elections are free but not fair, or there have been or there could have been some irregularities in the ballot box. We have one of the securest ballot and counting systems in the world.
But it's about more than just ballots, isn't it? It's also about the whole landscape in the run-up to the election. I mean, think about the way in which 90% of the media is controlled by or indeed in hoc to the government.
We have diversity of media. And in fact, in this particular election, the opposition decided to use social media very extensively, almost, I will say, aggressively. And I think they were somewhat misled by their own echo chamber effect in the social media. They thought that they were going to win. But regardless of that, I mean, they had access to conventional media as well as to social media at every level.
I'm so sorry to interrupt again, but they didn't really have access to conventional media, did they? I mean, if you think about the state-funded broadcaster TRT, I think in April, Mr. Kılıçdaroğlu had 32 minutes of airtime. Mr. Erdogan had 32 hours of airtime, according to one analysis. It wasn't a level playing field, was it?
Well, as I said, they had their own media outlets, they had their own rallies, they had their own campaign, every possible means, you know, that's available to any political candidate in the country. They had their own rallies and the demonstrations and et cetera. And if you ask anyone, you will say, I mean, you know, they've had hundreds of meetings around the country, closed door hall meetings, social media interviews, and so on and so forth. I don't think that the opposition will be justified to cite not having enough access to media as an explanation for their failure in this election.
İbrahim Kalin, a senior advisor and spokesperson for the Turkish president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Scientists in the United States have found evidence that a diet poor in chemicals known as flavanols may drive age-related memory loss. Sascha Schlichter has this report.
As more and more people around the world get to live to an older age, the problem of memory loss becomes increasingly acute. The study involved 3,500 healthy adults who took a daily flavanol supplement or a placebo for 3 years. Flavanols are compounds found in plant-based foods such as green tea, apples and berries. The team found that for those who had a poor diet at the start of the trial, consuming 500 milligrams of flavanols a day in the form of a supplement improved memory function. The authors say the findings raise the possibility of using flavanol-rich diets to improve cognitive function in older adults.
Sasha Slichter reporting. Still to come.
It's been calculated that the 8 billion tons of plastics that have been created by mankind since 1950 would carpet the whole of France with a layer 50 centimetres thick.
A major international conference on ending plastic pollution is taking place in Paris.
Hi, I'm Izzy Greenfield from Business Daily. We bring you important and interesting stories from the world of money and work. And we've been taking a deep dive into the music industry. It's worth $26 billion a year globally. And I've spoken to industry experts from around the world, from international pop stars and gospel groups to aspiring local artists, to find out what it takes to make it in such a lucrative but exclusive industry. That's Business Daily from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back. Spain's Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez has called a snap general election in July. That's following his party's poor results in Sunday's regional and local ballots. The Socialists lost two key regions to the Conservative People's Party, which also did well in a number of cities. The general election had been scheduled for the end of the year. Our correspondent Guy Hedgegow reports from Madrid.
The country was still digesting the scale of the socialist defeat when Pedro Sanchez went on national television to announce there would be an early general election.
I believe we need a clearer idea of the will of the Spanish men and women, a clearer idea of the policies that the government of the nation must apply. The best thing is for the men and women of Spain to speak up and speak out without delay to define the political course of the country.
Many observers are doubting if there is enough time for the socialists to recover before the vote on the 23rd of July. It had been scheduled to take place in December, but Mr. Sanchez clearly sees a benefit in this initiative. The July election will take place 3 weeks into Spain's tenure of the revolving EU presidency, which could burnish his image in the eyes of voters. Also, the election campaign will coincide with talks between the Conservative People's Party and far-right politicians from the Vox Party. Pedro Sanchez appears to be hoping that the prospect of the far-right taking up institutional posts across Spain will mobilise support for the left and deliver what currently appears an unlikely victory.
Guy Hedgegow in Spain. The engine maker Rolls-Royce and the British firm BAE Systems have been accused of corruption by authorities in India, who are investigating the sale of military aircraft to the Indian government. Peter Ruddick reports.
The alleged offences took place between 2003 and 2012, during which time India purchased 123 Hawk trainer jets. India's Central Bureau of Investigation has accused both Rolls-Royce and BAE Systems of several charges, including criminal conspiracy. As well as the two companies, several other individuals, including unnamed public officials, have been named in the filing, which is not yet a formal charge. In 2017, Rolls-Royce agreed to pay more than £600 million to British, American and Brazilian authorities as part of a bribery investigation, which looked into the jet purchases, as well as conduct in six other countries. The agreement was not an admission of criminal guilt. A spokesperson for Rolls-Royce said the company was assisting authorities in India and did not tolerate business misconduct. A spokesperson for BAE Systems said it was committed to maintaining high standards and would not comment further on an ongoing investigation.
Peter Ruddick. The French President Emmanuel Macron has warned that plastic waste is an environmental time bomb whilst he was speaking at the opening of a major conference on ending plastic pollution. Delegates from 175 different countries are meeting in the French capital at the headquarters of the UN scientific arm, UNESCO. It's hoped that a binding treaty could be ready for signing by the end of next year. Our Paris correspondent Hugh Schofield reports.
It's been calculated that the 8 billion tons of plastics that have been created by mankind since 1950 would carpet the whole of France with a layer 50 centimetres thick. Plastic particles are found at the bottom of the oceans and on mountain tops. They're in the air we breathe. The aim of these talks is to produce a treaty that will eliminate new plastic pollution by 2040. It's a tall order, but as President Macron said in his message, there is urgency.
Today, there is not a single place on the planet that has escaped plastic pollution, and this pollution is accelerating. If we do nothing, we will generate triple the amount of today's plastic waste by 2060. Plastic pollution is therefore a ticking time bomb, as well as a plague that has already started. It is our duty to end it as soon as possible.
If everyone agrees on the extent of the problem, finding common ground between 175 nations, as well as campaigners and industry, will not be easy. France and the UK are part of a bloc pushing for an eventual ban on single-use plastics, like most packaging, and for obligatory targets backed up by the threat of fines. The United States and China want targets to be voluntary. Oil-producing nations, remember plastic comes from hydrocarbons, want to focus on recycling. The talks here last till Friday. Three further rounds are planned. The hope is for a treaty to be signed early in 2025.
Hugh Schofield in Paris. So what can we do about the problem of plastic waste? Scientists say most of the vast amount of plastics we produce every year ends up in a landfill or in the sea. Tim Frank spoke to Mark Madonik, a professor of materials and society at University College London. So what are the key things that we need to keep in mind when it comes to plastic waste?
The thing we've got to realise is that as soon as you've used the product that's got plastic in it, which it might be your sneakers that you've bought, that you love, but now you're buying another pair and you don't know what to do with the other ones, or you've just got some packaging from a piece of lovely food you just got from the supermarket, and now you've taken the packaging off, and now you're about to put them in the bin. That's not the end of the story for that plastic. And we sort of think, oh, okay, someone's going to look after that. But they're not going to look after it. We do not have systems in place at the moment that look after that plastic. In many, many countries, more than half the world, there are no waste management systems for that stuff. So it's only going to go one place. It's only going to go into the environment.
So it's not a question of, look, let's just all try and use less plastic. I mean, although that may be laudable, because plastic is underpins so much of what we do, but we do need to think more about where this plastic goes once we've used it.
But most people can't actually extricate themselves from it. You know, you buy a phone, you buy a light, you want water to come to your house, you're buying plastic.
Or if you're poor,
these are the basics.
And if you're poor, Mark, you can only afford to buy, I don't know, a sachet of shampoo, say, or a sachet of soap. You know, you're going to buy it in a very small quantity and it's going to be packaged in plastic.
Yep, and that's your lifeline. You can't demonise people like that and say, oh, you shouldn't be doing that. We need to understand the social justice issues around plastic because it's part of the fabric of everybody's life on this planet.
Is it a question of economics, that it's actually just cheaper to produce new plastic rather than recycle old plastic? Or is it also to do with, I mean, is the science quite difficult here, that it is phenomenally difficult to recycle a lot of plastic?
The science for many of the plastics is done. So we actually have the technology to recycle, I'd say 50% that's out there. It's the economics. So it's actually more expensive to collect that plastic and then recycle it back into the system than it is to make new plastic from oil. Oil is this global trillion-dollar economy, and they've made it so efficient. The waste and recycling industries have to compete against a trillion-dollar industry, and they have no chance, roughly. At the moment, in developed countries, you have to get people to pay someone to come and take it away. It's actually negative value in your home. It's a cost to the society.
Mark Madonik, Professor of Materials and Society at University College London. Next to Latvia and the morning after the night before is probably what most Latvians were thinking, particularly those who'd had a few alcoholic drinks when they woke up on Monday. Their national team had just won third place in the Ice Hockey World Championships, beating the mighty United States to do so. But they were in for another treat, or in some cases more of a shock. Rachel Wright reports.
The moment Latvia scored against the United States, winning them the bronze medal and their best ever result at a world championship. Needless to say, ice hockey is extremely popular in this small Baltic nation of just 1.8 million people. Crowds in the capital Riga erupted with joy.
I've never watched hockey before, but today is an incredible win. It's a victory, not only for our national team,
but for the entire nation of Latvia.
The plane carrying the team home from Finland flew low over the city. As the country partied, MPs gathered in Parliament. One, with a face painted with the country's flag, giggled as she read out a list of absent parliamentarians. Then, at a quarter to midnight, the MPs who had turned up, dressed in red and white national team jerseys, convened for a 10-minute session to unanimously declare the following day, Monday, a national holiday.
Atturs trīs likums ir pieņemts.
A couple of hours later, the nation woke up, and instead of having the mother of all hangovers, they had an unexpected day off. But there was confusion about who was working and who was not. Court hearings were cancelled, schools and universities were closed. Several hospitals chose to stay open, but many businesses found themselves in some disarray, with the president of the Latvian Chamber of Commerce saying it will be chaos for many. Oh, and in case you were wondering, Canada won the gold medal, Germany the silver.
Rachel Wright reporting. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. Before we go, here's Jackie Leonard.
We asked and you said yes. So the Happy Pod is going to be a regular thing, an upbeat addition to the Global News podcast feed every Saturday from June the 10th. You know the sort of thing, positive stories that are inspiring, brilliant or funny. And we need you to get involved. Start by sending in the sound of the thing that brings you joy. The usual address, globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. Thank you.
And if you want to comment on this podcast, use the same email. You can also find us on Twitter @GlobalNewsPod. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.